Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Three Women, Three Ways, for the show that talks about things that are going on in the news, and we look at it from our three different perspectives as three women who've lived life in, with some similarities and a lot of differences. Deborah, joining me today is Deborah Adams and Pinkley, Connie Sue, and I'd like Connie Sue to introduce yourself a little bit. Connie Sue?
Well, good morning, Heather, and good morning, Deb, and good morning, listeners. Yep, this is Pinkley here. I currently am working in the field of ending violence against women through a local nonprofit domestic violence program in Thurston County, Washington, Olympia. And I have a bachelor's degree in social justice from our local Evergreen State College, and interesting perspectives from that sort of academic process. But here I am, and good morning. And Deborah, how about you?
Good morning, sisters. This is Deborah Adams, and I'm happy to be here as well. My background is a survivor of experience, and so my tagline is I've lived it, I've studied it, and I've worked it. So I spent a lot of my time the last 30 years looking into domestic violence and all forms of violence against women through academia, as well as through my professional work at a community-based program. And I, as I said, I am a survivor, and I'm also a grandmother of 8 kids, which was very exciting and very fun place to be at in my life. Heather, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I have been interested in this field for about the last 12 years, and I took a definite academic approach to it, and I got a master's degree from University of Colorado focusing on domestic violence against women, and I am currently taking my last class as a PhD candidate before I start my dissertation, and my dissertation is going to be on the impact or whether there's a relationship between experiencing domestic violence in a woman's lifetime and her later job satisfaction. So it's kind of going to be kind of a study that nobody's done before. So I hope it'll be some groundwork for learning more about the long-term effects of domestic violence and its impact on women's long-term life. And so that's where I am at. And where we're at today is, I think most people have been aware in the news that VAWA, Violence Against Women's Act, is in the news, and it's up for renewal, and there's some controversy about it. So why don't we first of all explain what it is, Deborah?
What is
the Violence Against Women's Act?
I'd be happy to talk about the Violence Against Women Act. And if people want to find out some more information about it, you can actually go to our Facebook page. Our Facebook page is 3Divas LLC, and we have some information already posted there for you to look at. And also, I'd like to invite you to call in this morning if you'd like to join our conversation. The call-in number is 646-378-0430. And Heather, are you opening up the chat?
Well, I am. I'm trying to right now.
Not there yet, huh?
Not there quite yet.
Okay. Sometimes we do have technical difficulties. So the Violence Against Women Act is actually 15 years old. And it was initiated in 1994 after about 15 years of background and legislative decision-making. And actually this whole event, the Violence Against Women Act, was initiated by our current Vice President Joseph Biden. Of course, then he was a senator from Delaware. But he worked with a lot of people. And I want to acknowledge the hard work that one particular woman did, and her name was Sheila Wellstone. She was married to Paul, who was a senator from Minnesota. But she became involved in domestic violence by listening and learning and then studying, and she established herself as one of the nation's leading experts on the problem of domestic violence. So she played a key role. And there's also an organization that is called the National, where did I write that? They're the task force that works on the authorization of VAWA each time it comes up. So it's pretty well organized group of, and it's a nationwide effort, of course. And in 1994, when President Bill Clinton signed the act, VAWA was hailed as a success of historic proportions on various political and social fronts. It was undeniably a victory for feminism, but it was also a civil rights victory. And to that event, we'll say that the primary reasons they wanted this law named the Violence Against Women Act is because there was some, well, our criminal justice system is gender neutral, and a lot of us who have worked in the field and lived it and studied it feel that domestic violence, sexual assault, and all forms of violence against women have a gender-biased venue. So in order to protect...
Now, wait a minute. When you say gender bias, that means that it talks about, because the VAWA is a violence against women, so that's
right.
A bias there, gender bias, that it doesn't include men?
Yes, Heather, you're right. People can take that in a really negative way. But in fact, gender bias in this case is a positive way because, as we know, domestic violence, sexual assault, and all forms of violence against women, the most common characteristic is to be a woman.
Yeah.
So there needs to be some way to use our gender-neutral law system, right? It shouldn't matter. There should be no discrimination. And then apply it to something that is definitely gender biased, such as violence against women and domestic violence.
Well, that was the glitch last time it was up for renewal, when a number of men's groups objected to its renewal because it didn't have that gender neutral language, because it didn't include men as an abused group, right?
Right. So men were feeling that was discriminatory. It was actually after the passing of VAWA in 1994 that it was actually challenged almost immediately by a case called Cleveland versus Whitner, who was a man who claimed his rights had been violated because he claimed the Ohio Police Department received funds to prosecute men only. But that is not actually how the law reads, and that case was not upheld. So it has been deemed a couple other times after that. Also, there's been some cases, and each time it is, VAWA has been upheld as non-discriminatory.
Mm-hmm. So now we come to, so what you were saying is it was started in 1994 amidst challenges for a number of reasons. And how come that it isn't just permanent? Why do they have to keep renewing it?
The law is written, it needs to be reauthorized, so it's written for a specific time period. And I think that was written that way in order to make it, easier to work with and add things. And also it has to do with the funding, I believe. They didn't want to set, like a certain amount of funding that would be available for it for the rest of eternity.
Yeah. So
funding is also another picture of this, what people are either for it or against it, I believe.
Okay. So when you say funding for it, what kinds of funding is required for this? You already mentioned that money is available through the Act for some prosecutions. What other things does this Act provide funding for?
Well, it also focuses on, in 1994, they had the vision that it would develop across the nation a coordinated community response because as it was, each state and then each county and then each city in the United States was having their own reaction and response to domestic violence. And because this is such an epidemic of such magnitude, so many people are impacted by it, they thought there should be a federal response. So the first thing they focused on was much-needed aid to victims in the aftermath of violence. And it also was law officer training. It was protection for police officers in dangerous assaults. It's also included protection for battered immigrants. It worked on prevention and education. And it also helped federal prosecution for interstate crimes. And then also it was about full faith and credit, and that was a pretty big deal.
What does that mean?
So full faith and credit means if I go to my county court, excuse me, and ask for an order of protection, and then say I move to, so I'm in Vancouver, Washington, and Portland, Oregon is 20 minutes away from me. So say I move to Portland, Oregon, that order of protection is now valid in Oregon.
Okay.
Prior to the Violence Against Women Act, it would not have been. I would have had to establish my residency in Oregon for whatever length of time that is, and then would have had to have another assault in order to apply for an order of protection in Oregon. So this full faith and credit, it also helps with tribal jurisdictions, if people are familiar with that. Tribal reservations have their own law enforcement system and criminal justice system, and they can only prosecute Native Americans that are on their reservation. So perhaps one of their tribe travels to another reservation and creates a crime, then there's jurisdiction issues. So full faith and credit kind of erases those jurisdictional issues. Is that clear?
Yeah, I think it's clear. Binkley, you think that's clear?
Yes. I understand that very well.
Yeah, okay.
I mean,
you're doing such a good job of explaining all this, Deborah. I don't think either one of us wants to interrupt you.
I'm kind of passionate about it, and I don't know why I'm so passionate about it. You know, I didn't used to be that involved in political processes and laws and all that, but this particular piece of legislation has really intrigued me.
Yeah, well, keep going, because you're giving us a lot of good information.
Okay.
You're giving us kind of a historical background here. So now where does that put us today?
Yeah, where it puts us today. So in 2000, they improved the act and in particular improved the enforcement of the full faith and credit, because before that was in writing, but nobody ever really paid any attention to it. But in 2000, it seemed to have enough impact, and people had enough training that they were able to actually enforce it and make it meaningful.
Okay.
So 2005 was the next time it was reauthorized. And what 2005 authorization brought, it included court training and improvements, child witness, and culturally specific programs. So that enhanced the, or made more clear who was eligible as a victim of domestic violence and sexual assault.
Well, and didn't it have something to do with including people with disabilities? And
yes, it was culturally sensitive. So what they're saying is that there actually is no one-size-fits-all response to domestic violence, because those of us who have lived and worked in the field and studied it know that it crosses all socio and economical boundaries and lines, imaginary lines, and so it doesn't matter if you have a GED or a PhD or if you live in rural Mississippi or if you live in New York City, we're all entitled to have culturally sensitive services around domestic violence, sexual assault, and all forms of violence.
Okay. And there was one other thing that they did that I thought was, kicking out of you can't be evicted. Didn't they include that one in 2005? Where it protected...
That was one. And let's see. Well, it goes from 2005 to 2012. So, yes, they had some housing enhancements, too. You're right.
Which means
absolutely.
People could, a woman couldn't be kicked out just because of somebody who was stalking her or abusing her. Is that correct?
That is correct. Absolutely okay. Correct. And that was as far as economic abuse, that was a huge thing. I mean, if someone comes to your house and trashes it and assaults you and then you're evicted, that doesn't quite seem logical nor fair.
Yeah, exactly. So, okay. So each time they renewed it, they added a few more things.
Right.
What about the funding? Did the funding keep going up for this?
Pinkley, you want to talk about funding? You found some interesting information out about that.
Well, and actually, in coincidence, Deb and I kind of came across the same information, so it's pretty validating that I did the right research on this and got the same information. What I found that the funding aspect of it is quite complicated. However, just basically the bottom line is here in 2009, the total amount for appropriations for the VAWA Act was $595 million for violence against women's programs. 2010 was $625 million, and for 2011, it's $649. That's $649 million. And I think that what I'd like to do is kind of go back to Deb's comment about her passion around this. I think that it's deeply rooted in the idea or the scarcity of the thought of if this doesn't pass, that funding for programs throughout the country could be eliminated. And that's pretty scary. The Violence Against Women's Act funds not only some, and of course there's also state funding, and as a nonprofit we're always doing fundraising from our local community, but it also not only funds shelters, but it also funds our hotlines for people to actually call in and get support over the phone. And to break it down even a little bit further, it also not only works with the domestic violence shelters, but also the Encourage to Arrest and also our sexual assault service programs. So, for example, not only the programs through the sexual assault programs, but if someone was to go to the hospital and request a rape exam, part of that funding comes from this. So it's a very multi-layered funding source. And what I also found very interesting is that the VAWA actually expired 704 days ago.
Whoa!
The last time Congress acted on VAWA was 206 days ago. The last day Congress can pass VAWA for this year is in 5 days.
Oh, boy.
So there is definitely a sense of urgency around this, and I think that part of it is because it's been with us. We don't realize the consequences so much if it actually goes away. So it's really critical that this funding gets passed. Any thoughts around that?
I agree with that. What do you think, Heather?
Well, I think I didn't realize that it was so crucial. And to me, I just can't imagine them not passing it. I mean, what is this, all a political ploy or really philosophical differences? I don't understand why there's the big bugaboo. I mean, in this day and age, most people, including our politicians, recognize what a huge problem violence
against
women is.
Well, I think part of it is political. It's being politically driven. As you asked the question to Deb, why does it have to get, you know, passed every 4 years? Well, part of it is budget. There's always budget analysis. But also for the option improvement or changes to this. And one of the changes, there are actually, one is Native Americans being inclusive to adding specifically around Native Americans, the LGBT community, the lesbian, gay, bi, and trans community, and immigrants. The final issue at hand is giving of U visas to immigrants who find themselves victims of domestic violence. The original version of the VAWA contained provisions that allowed undocumented victims of domestic violence to apply for legal status. So they're making these in part of the VAWA status. And I want to clarify one thing about men. Men are also victims of domestic violence, and I want to ensure our listeners that we would not ever turn a man away from our program. We provide services to everyone, and however they may identify. So it's not really, for me personally, it's not really an issue of, well, men are not included. Violence against women is the main issue. Women are the primary targets of violence by men. However, we recognize that men can be also victimized. So our local program does not turn any man away, which really infuriates me to think that that people would think that we don't provide services to men because they're not included specifically in this act.
Well, yeah, I think that's true, but I also think that, you know, that most people don't realize how few incidents there are of woman against male violence. I mean, I think the media kind of propels it disproportionately. They make it seem like it's like 50-50, and it sure isn't. So.
And it sure isn't. And the other thing that I want also to clarify is that we're a dual agency in our county, which means we serve survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. And someone doesn't have to be presently assaulted sexually. We provide services to people who have been sexually abused or molested in childhood. And we have a lot of requests from male survivors who have had that experience somewhere in their lifetime. So this just isn't about domestic violence. It also includes the importance of doing work with survivors of sexual assault.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so what's the big bugaboo this time? You know, it sounds like they're just really caught. Is it all because of the election that they're not moving forward on this? You know, is the fiscal cliff taking so much precedence that this is not considered important anymore? I mean, what's the deal?
Well, I think Pinkley said it true. It had a lot to do with waiting for the election of our president. I think the House of Representatives, which is Republican-led majority-wise, wanted to wait and see who was going to be president because President Obama and Vice President Biden are definitely in support of getting Violence Against Women Act reauthorized. And I think that, you know, if Governor Romney had been elected, there might have been a different sense of that. It might have changed to I'm not really willing to support it. And one of the things that I find hard to understand is that Republicans and Democrats have both supported the Violence Against Women Act traditionally and historically up to this point. So, but for this time, what they're saying is, we think it's fine the way it is. We don't think you need to add specific language that makes it, that ensures that people of same-sex relationships, that undocumented immigrants And also Native Americans, you know, they don't need equal access. So I think we talked about this on a previous show. I can't understand why it's okay up to the point where we don't want to serve anybody who doesn't look like a white Caucasian male, you know. That's my problem. But it is supposedly hinging around the language in those three categories.
Well, right now, there's a House version and there's a Senate version. What's the difference between the two?
Right. The House version actually is, The House version, they put together a House version that was not acceptable to the Senate or the President. And so then they wanted to look towards how they can come together. And there's two senators from Canada, Senator Cole and...
From where, Deb?
Yeah.
From where?
From California.
California. Okay. I thought you said Canada.
Oh, sorry. California. It's my voice. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Issa and Cole. And they've put together a House version that would include the language that would be acceptable to the Senate people and to the Vice President. So they're in some kind of negotiation, kind of behind the door negotiation about how we can get this passed, which seems a little creepy to me, you know.
Nevertheless, that is how they do a lot of stuff. So. Yeah.
It's a subject of national interest, and so why are they having closed door, conversations about it? But so right now, it actually looks like. Congressman Issa has given us a path forward that allows us to protect all victims. But House leadership needs to hear from you. Your representatives need to hear from you. So at this point, I'd like to make that call for action to call them and ask them to pass the House bill. And so you can call the White House switchboard.
You want them to pass the House bill or the Senate bill?
Okay, let me just give them the number first. The House the White House phone number is 888-269-5702. That will connect you to the Capitol switchboard. Ask to be connected to your U.S. representative or senator. And ask your members of Congress to tell you they will sign on as a co-sponsor or pledge their support for the Issa Cole House version. Compromised language, it's called H.R. 6625. And again, you can find this on our Facebook page.
Okay.
And then the second action is to call Speaker... I'm not sure you say his name, B-O-E-H-N-E-R?
Boehner.
Boehner, thank you. And Leader Cantor. So Boehner is with the Senate and Cantor is with the House. Also using the number above, and tell them that a final Violence Against Women Act that does not protect Native women and hold perpetrators accountable is unacceptable. Urge them to support the Issa Cole Compromise. That includes language that would be fair to protect all victims.
Okay. So why don't you give that phone number again, Deborah?
Sure. The 888-269-5702. And you want to ask them to sign on as a co-sponsor or pledge their support for H.R. 6625. So you want to talk to your own specific, your own specific representatives and senators, and then you want to call the two leaders of the two houses, which is Boehner for the Senate and Cantor for the representatives and tell them the same thing.
Now, if you don't know who your representative or your senator who they are, you can. There's all sorts of places to find out. You can call your county board of elections. You can go online and look at that. You can also access League of Women Voters, and they will tell you what district you're in and who your representatives are. So,
I also have a website directly that I'd like to do a shout out for.
Awesome.
You can find your representative at www.house.gov/representatives/find. So there's also an easy access to a website directly to find that information.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. So I'd like each of you to just kind of say, okay, why is it so important? What's going to happen if this doesn't pass?
If it doesn't pass, it will decimate our coordinated community response that we've spent the last 15 years building. And that seems a real negative path to go down.
Mm-hmm.
It also would entail people losing jobs, which I don't think the Republicans want that right now, because aren't they all about we need to create more jobs? Or if you don't pass the Violence Against Women Act, you're looking at people who will be losing positions, because it does support staff in both law enforcement agencies, courthouse systems, and the advocacy systems.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I don't think it's just one party or the other that needs to be goosed into action here. I think that, you know, it needs to be addressed by both sides of the aisle. And so no matter who your representative is, no matter what party they're with, give them a call and tell them, you know, let's make something happen here. Let's get this going. And I think when I was asking you what's going to happen, what I was thinking is, gosh, if this doesn't pass, we've just snapped back to 1994 in our response to violence against women. I mean, think about all the progress that's been made in the last 20 years. And the VAWA, Violence Against Women Act, played a large part in that.
Absolutely.
Not only with prosecution, not only with investigation, training police officers, helping provide protections for women who've been abused. It's also done a lot for the attitudes and the expectations in our country about violence against women. And if we just let this expire and lose all of that progress we've made in 20 years, 18 years, then what are we saying about our attitudes about violence against women? I mean, I just find that absolutely reprehensible, that we would be slapped back 20 years. As far as, you know, our progress in domestic violence and sexual assault. So
we
I think
also have an infographic on our Facebook page that says, why do we need Violence Against Women Act? And it says, because 1 in 4 women are going to be victims of domestic violence. Those women need the Violence Against Women Act. And every day, 3 women are murdered by their partners. Those could be prevented. And also, 1.3 million women report being raped or sexually assaulted. Those women need the support and the systems in place for the aftercare of that violent episode, assault in their life. And also, there are 15 million children who are exposed to domestic violence each year. So we're talking each year that 15 million children are witnessing or actually being assaulted, either way, one way or the other. So they're impacted by domestic violence. And, Heather, you know what the research on that is.
Yeah. So
share that?
Yeah. I'm not going to repeat the research, but, yeah, I think it's I'm still stuck in this snapping back to 1994, and I'm trying to remember what things were like back then. And as I recall, most people didn't even acknowledge that domestic violence was a huge problem back then.
Right.
you know, it just wasn't perceived as that big of a problem. It happened. It was quiet, and it happened on occasion. It was perceived as something very rare. And I just am absolutely gobsmacked by the idea that, you know, all of this progress would just go away. Please give us a call, and give us a call at 646-378-0430. We'd like to hear what you have to say about the VAWA Act. Maybe you're opposed to it. Give us a call. Let us know. Join our discussion. Deborah, what is there anything other than calling their representatives that people can do?
I think they can talk about it. The more people that are aware of the need, or you know, to pass Violence Against Women Act, or even know that it exists, the better off we're going to be. It shouldn't be so hard for our political leaders to make a decision on this type of legislation, especially since we already have 15 years history with it, where it has made an impact on lessening the level of violence that people are experiencing. Do you have any thoughts about that, Connie Sue?
Well, I don't. Several. I'm actually looking at it, reviewing a document here, and I think the importance is to break this down a little bit. It's number one, the priority is services to survivors and victims. I would ask the question simply: where would people go, and who would they call? It, like Heather says, it sets us back almost 20 years. I mean, I can't even imagine the progress that we've worked so hard to achieve would just all of a sudden go away. I am not terribly concerned that it's not going to be passed, and I also want to highlight that there are funding cuts to this in the verge of this hypothetical fiscal cliff that we're nearing towards. I think that it will be passed. I think they're working out politically the differences and the highlights of what it includes as far as semantics on who the survivors are. I think the highlight of immigrants, lesbian, gay, and trans community, and Native American women, is the level of incidences is higher in that community. And so they're trying to provide provisions in working with all survivors. This funding also includes STOP, VOCA, services for rural survivors. It also includes a portion of engaging men and youth in prevention efforts. It touches on civil legal assistance, transitional housing, violence on campuses, elder abuse, court training. I mean, the court training for judicial officers, court commissioners, and judges is paramount in all of this. It also includes research and provisions to address the needs of communities of color, people who are not your white Caucasian person. This does not just include the white population. It includes everyone. It crosses all ethnic and social boundaries. It also includes in the health and human services field, family violence prevention. So family violence, that means, as you said, the impact of children who have witnessed domestic violence. It includes rape prevention and educational information. So it encompasses quite a few funding levels. It's not just the core services on shelters and the helpline or the hotline or the crisis line for people to call into. So it's a very complicated and layered funding that will impact so many levels. Our healthcare, you know, our mental health care system, our judicial system, law enforcement, training for judicial officers, which has been incredibly important in how they respond to survivors.
Okay, so when we talk about Violence Against Women Act, we talk about protections and we talk about funding. who could be opposed to this? Because you gave the figures on funding. They haven't gone up dramatically. They're, you know, as far as government spending is concerned, the funds are relatively minimal in this issue. So who is opposed to this? Who's standing in the way of this going on? I mean, that was one of my questions. And I did a little research here, and I found a men's group. And it seems like some of the men's groups out there that are very vocal do not believe that VAWA is doing all it can for all people. And one of the quotes that I found, which just kind of knocked my socks off, is from the National Coalition for Men, NCFM. And they said that the Senate alternative will ensure more of the abused are better served and provide protections for the, and this is a quote, true victims of domestic violence, heterosexual men. So if there is this kind of an attitude out there, and we're talking about a quote from a national coalition, of course, you know, that could have a number of definitions, but the implication is that there are more than a couple people that believe in this. They're back to talking about how the true victims of domestic violence are men, and if VAWA is spending money for women's issues, then it's not addressing those true victims, the heterosexual men. Now, while I sit here steaming about that, why don't you talk? Why don't you talk a little bit about it, Pinkley? And you've talked a lot about what VAWA has done and the services that it's made available. What about this whole idea that VAWA doesn't protect the true victims?
Can I interject here? This is Deb.
Sure.
What I feel the fathers' rights are claiming that men are the true victims because they're being held accountable to pay child support, and also if they do assault their partner, they're being held accountable with a fine, maybe some treatment, maybe even jail. So that's how I view the men's quotation of saying men's are the real victims, is because they're being held accountable.
Yeah, and I always think.
And so that, to me, is a backwards way of thinking. To be held accountable is not a punishment. Doesn't necessarily have to be a punishment anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, if the men would self-regulate and hold themselves accountable, we wouldn't be even having this conversation.
Sounds like you're as steamy as I am over that one, Deborah.
All right, well, let's quickly take it away.
Okay.
Well, honestly, the first thought that came to mind is all abusers believe they're the victims.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nothing less than that. Or nothing more.
Yeah.
I mean,
well,
that's a very typical statement that they truly, I mean, and honestly, they truly do believe they're the victims.
Yeah.
And as Deb said, it's like, where's the accountability piece?
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't have to be a bad thing. I mean, you know, not all women want to separate from their partners. They want them to get help. They want them to stay within their families and keep their families together. So what's wrong with that? We're talking about acts of violence that occur against women is the majority of the issue here.
Yeah.
That's the issue.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that I think of, you know, Deborah, you were saying that it holds them accountable. I think that since abuse against women is usually a control issue, I mean, almost predominantly a control issue, the abusers are used to having control, and for the first time, they're up against a court system which actually has a bigger hammer than anything that the abusers have ever encountered before. So suddenly, here, they're faced with somebody who has more control than them, and I think that's a really difficult pill for them to take. And so their reactions are pretty strong against that. It's like, what do you mean somebody, this court system has control over me? And I always think that rage that they have is kind of a reaction along those lines. You know, wait a minute, I'm the one that controls, and now there's a court controlling me? Uh-uh. So, I don't know. Well,
yeah, I pulled up a document from that's talking about the Violence Against Women Act, 15 years of working together. And actually, they start the history of the Violence Against Women Act in 1871, where Alabama is the first state to rescind the legal right of men to beat their wives. So we've been talking about domestic violence in the United States since 1871. It's close to my mind.
Yeah.
You know? And then in the late 60s and early 70s, we started having shelters opening. But before that, I remember in my historical studies that the first battered women's shelters were where the nuns lived. So in the 1500s,
well, yes. I mean, didn't...
1200s, the 600s, that's where women went when they were battered, was to live behind the locked fence of the nuns' house.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Well, and I think that back in the early 60s and 70s, weren't most shelters started? I mean, there wasn't funding for a shelter, so they would actually have like an underground of homes that women could go to. Actually, you know, I mean, how committed are those women that they actually just like put it right on the line and accept offer shelter directly to somebody who's being abused? I mean, that was a risky thing, and I just keep thinking about that. Our foremothers that took those risks in order to help somebody who is being abused. I mean, wow, that's gutsy.
Well, actually, that's the history of my domestic violence shelter in my community. In 1974, a group of women got together and rented an apartment. And that was the first shelter in our community. That's exactly what it was. There was no funding. There was no coalition. There was no public figure or legislative leader to talk to about that. They just went and did it. And actually, that's how all the hotlines started, too. It was just people saying, I'm going to get this phone number, and we're all going to take turns answering it. You know, there really was no funding. So I think that this is kind of evolution of social change movements is where they start out really grassroots, where everybody's, it's like a revolution, you know. And then as we get more experienced and smarter, we start learning how to work within the systems that are impeding progress. And then all of a sudden you get co-opted by the systems. And then the federal government does offer funding support for that. And then all of a sudden, everybody wants that piece of money, whether they really believe in the initial cause or not. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. So, again, talking about this group of men who is opposed to Violence Against Women Act because they see it as... ignoring the true victims, the heterosexual male. When you're talking about that, is it that they want their cut of the pie, or they just don't want women to have a cut of the pie? What's the deal? Do you know? Any speculation?
I think they don't want women to have the pie, and I think they don't want to be held accountable. I mean, some of the basic studies that have been done about perpetrators of domestic violence and sexual assault incidents is that it's a need for power and control, right? It's not about sex. It's not about love.
It's not about what you cooked for dinner.
Not about what you cooked for dinner. Not about how you raise your kids. It's about this arbitrary need for power and control over everybody. So I think that... you know, that's kind of coupled. And that's why one of my things is I've been recreating myself since I lost my job at the community-based program is that I so strongly believe that we need to change our social and cultural norms because those are the things that are unwritten and in place that everybody honors without ever talking about or, you know, so until we change the social and cultural norms that perpetuate and condone violence, I don't think, you know, we're ever going to truthfully work ourselves out of a job, and I really would like to do that.
Well, and having seen some of the video games where, you know, boy, some of those video games are so misogynistic, I just have very little hope for, you know, young boys being raised right now who are exposed to those games and who are actually quite committed to those games. How are those boys going to grow up any differently from, you know, the in-control, misogynistic kind of man who we tend to think of as an abuser? I mean, how our culture is just so permeated with violence against women that we don't even acknowledge it on most levels. What do you think? That's my opinion anyway. Pinkley?
Well, I think that's a big statement, Heather.
Well, you can go ahead and pick it up. You can pick it apart. It's okay.
No, I agree with everything. I think that the important part of this also is to remember that in a more simplistic way, for me to think about it, is really when you're serving a mom, you are serving the family. You are helping those kids to grow up and understand and hopefully prevent continued violence against women. I mean, if we don't help the families, and that's how I look at it, is we help the family unit. It's, you know, like I said, I did legal advocacy for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, and I worked every day in a court system where people were wanting to get protection orders or feeling the need to do that. But in most situations, they didn't want to be away from the partner or the father or their husbands. They wanted the abuse to stop.
Yeah.
They
wanted,
I
want to hear about my 12-year-old grandson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I love my grandkids, but he came to do some work. He wanted to earn some money.
Uh-huh.
And he says, Grandma, my dad says we can't go to Walmart because their workers are on strike, and his dad's a union worker. I said, okay, I'm fine with that. I don't go to Walmart anyway. You know, my dad was a union worker. I can honor that. And I said, but I have a lot of other reasons why I don't go to Walmart. He goes, why? Why wouldn't you go to Walmart, Grandma? And I said, because they have a history of not paying men and women equally for the same job. They don't offer health benefits, and they don't offer sick leave and vacation leave to their employees. They don't work them full time. They outsource a lot of the things that they manufacture for themselves. And he was like, wow, that's good. And I said, no, it's not. So he went home. And the next day, my daughter, his mom, called me and says, Mom, Alex came home. I swear to God, he says, Mom, did you know Walmart doesn't pay women the same as they pay men? That's wrong. And I wonder, I feel bad for my sisters. What can I do about that? And she shared that with me. She goes, I knew he'd been talking to you, Mom.
yeah. Sometimes I feel sorry for our sons, you know.
You won't do it, I will.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because my father, this is a little aside here, but my father was the next to the youngest in his family and had 7 sisters. And I never knew growing up that this man had such a feminist outlook on life. He was the manly man, you know. I mean, he worked in a factory, he repaired cars, he had grease under his fingernails and all that kind of stuff. But he had such a feminist perspective on life that it was just amazing to me. So maybe, you know, you and I when we encounter, you know, people who are forming their opinions and we get our 2 cents worth in, maybe we're the ones who are making a change in the world. How's that for aggrandizement?
I like it.
You know, but when they used to say the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world, maybe it's the hand that the mind that shares the facts that rules the world. I don't know. Well, we're starting to come to the end of our program. We've got a few minutes left. What's the most important thing, Pinkley, that you would like people to take away from this show?
Be educated. Get educated on it.
Mm-hmm.
Understand the importance of it. It's not just some hypothetical thing that's out there that is going to go away. I mean, if the funding goes away, the problems are only going to get, they're going to become exponential. I mean, our communities are impacted by violence against women. Every person, although it may not happen to you directly, is being impacted by this.
Yeah.
And so I would say, get involved and take action. And
again, that phone number that they can call for their congressman, Deborah, do you have that?
Let me
it's 888-269-5702.
Thanks,
Pinkley. Okay. Take action.
Yeah. So give it one more time here, Pinkley. It's
888-269-5702.
Okay, and that will hook them up to the White House switchboard. They can look up online who their representative, who their senator is before they give that phone call, and then they can get connected right with that senator or congressman's office, or representative's office, rather, and they can leave the message of how important it is for the Violence Against Women Act to be renewed. You know, find a compromise and renew that sucker. Deborah, do you have any, what would you like our listeners to leave? What's the most important thing we talked about today?
I would like them to know what the Violence Against Women Act is, or at least have an idea so they could talk about it at their next holiday party. And I would ask them to take action now, I mean today, this weekend, you know, to make that call, because this is, we've only got a few days left in what they call the lame duck session, and I think we need to pass this before they go, our senators and our representatives go home to spend the holidays with their families. So, that's what I'd like. And, you know, generally I close with a quote. So today I thought it was appropriate that we use one of my very favorite quotes from Margaret Mead. And it is, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has." And nothing more truer than that for us today, as we're talking about this lame duck session, and we want to get the Violence Against Women Act passed. Any closing comments, Heather?
So, well, just one more time, Deborah, what's the website, or was it Pinkley that had that, the website you can go to find out if you don't know who your congressman and who your senator are? What's that website again?
I lost that. It's not right directly in front of me. I had it up on a tab here, but...
Okay. Well, the important thing is that it's not hard. You can call or go to the League of Women Voters website.
Right.
You can go to your website for your County Board of Elections. There are a number of places you can go if you don't know who your representative or your senator are. And you look that up, you find out who's representing you, and then you call 888-269-5702. That's the White House switchboard. Tell them who you want to talk to, and don't stop with one. Go ahead and call the other one, and make sure that they understand how important the Violence Against Women Act is and how incredibly important it is that it be passed. So we've covered a lot of political ground today, ladies. Any final thoughts, Pinkley?
I think that we can all agree that this needs to get done and to take action today, as you said, on, you know, calling in. And as Deborah's quote indicated, we can all make a difference. And don't just leave it to someone else. You as an individual can make a difference.
Absolutely.
And close our show today.
Well, I have to confess, I haven't yet called. So as soon as the show is over, guess what I'm going to be doing? I'm going to be calling. So we've done a lot of thinking today. We've covered a lot of ground, and we really enjoy that we were able to share this with you, because we are
three women,
three ways,
three divas. Join us next Saturday, same time, 10 a.m. Pacific time.
Absolutely.
Yep.